But if you were listening last night, you'll recall my first guest after seven was Tony Wright, author of a book called Left in the Dark. Not a bestseller, but interesting nonetheless. In it, he argues humanity has been held back by a dysfunctional brain, specifically the left hemisphere of our brain, stunted by a change in our diet, he thinks about 500,000 years ago, which is holding back the potential of our right hemispheres. He reckons even our social order is based so much on maintaining security. It's a reaction to the fearful and paranoid tendencies of our dominant left hemisphere brain. It's getting us into a mess, he says. Yesterday we focused on what's gone wrong, in Tony Wright's opinion. This evening, I asked Tony to explain how we might be able to get our brains on track, to get back into our right minds, so to speak. Or is humanity stuck with its dysfunctional brain?
I certainly hope not. In fact, a lot of my motivation comes from being fairly convinced that, A, we can tap into that lost potential, as you put it, and more importantly, again, than that, I suspect, is preventing the damage that I'm proposing goes on with the left hemisphere. Preventing that in the first place would be much more of a fundamental objective.
And how do we do that?
I was going to say, my suggestion would be, if you step back from the sort of concepts, the beliefs, the dogmas that come with modern interpretations of religion, and you just look at what people used to do historically, and some of these practices have survived into modern times. If you just look at what people were actually trying to do to access what they called higher states of consciousness or more functional states of consciousness, I think there's a lot of clues there. Basically, there were techniques that would inhibit or suppress the dominance of the left hemisphere, anything from meditating, not talking, right through to sleep deprivation, which we can talk about some more.
Well, we talked about that with you a few months back when you said, was it a new world record for how many days without sleeping?
Yeah, I did just over 11 days. I was particularly interested in Randy Gardner's record, simply because it was very well known, very well documented. But part of the link to my research was that sleep deprivation is a very old and traditional approach to vision quest, to accessing these unusual states.
Yeah, to higher consciousness.
And I wanted to sort of put it on the agenda that maybe there's some sense in that. Maybe there was a reason why that might actually help if you make the right preparations, where you're effectively tiring out your neural system, but because the left side isn't as efficient, you know, make the case that it's not working very well, it gets tired much more quickly and starts to lose its ability to stay in charge, and you do end up with a window of feeling tired, and that's where all the dysfunction comes from sleep deprivation.
Did you go beyond that, you think?
Well, yeah, that's the idea. If you go beyond that, you start getting into a wholly different state of being where the tiredness tends to dissipate for the most part, and you start feeling good, and there's abilities slowly start to emerge that aren't there normally, and that's a conundrum in itself.
What happened with you, Tony, when you achieved that record a few months ago?
Well, to be perfectly honest, the record was quite intentionally an exercise to draw attention to my research. So
You were playing a left hemisphere game there.
Well, possibly a bit, but I was intentionally staying awake, but I wasn't too keen on slipping into all sorts of unusual states if I could possibly manage that, simply because it may have been misinterpreted or misunderstood.
If you started saying, I can see God.
Well, you know, that kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah.
If you like, or just, you know, perhaps, my voice can change, the way I conceptualize things changes, and I didn't want to present too much too quickly, although things did happen behind the scenes a bit, the kind of things that have happened before. And certainly what's happened in the past where I've done a lot of this stuff, including, I may have mentioned this previously, there was a university-based study where quite clearly, and contrary to expectations, abilities do seem to emerge. Sort of 3, 4, 5 days in, you go through this tiredness and then you start coming out the other side, and sure enough, it does seem to get better.
What sort of things happen to you when you're in a sleep-deprived state?
Well, the things that we got some really good results on were more physical. I felt they were easy to measure. I can talk about some of the perceptual changes, but they're, you know, it's very difficult to sort of test and measure those.
Yeah.
But we certainly got improved. Myself and another chap who'd followed a similar preparation, our coordination and balance improved, our stamina, our strength, all the kind of things that would normally be heading in the other direction the longer you stay awake. They all improved during the study we did, which was fully monitored. And in addition to that, I'd say, I mean, things like just a very powerful feel-good factor, you know, bordering on kind of mild to moderate euphoria and just feeling completely relaxed and much easier to engage with people. And those are some of the less tangible things. And then the way your kind of thinking seems to work changes, and it seems to move from joining one or two dots at a time to being able to see whole patterns and pictures of information and making connections that normally wouldn't be made. That certainly seems to be an element that creeps in on a repeated and recurring basis.
Do you think that depriving ourselves of sleep is a tool that everyone should try, or do we not know really enough about the brain yet for people to be just trying that willy-nilly?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm certainly not advocating that it's an easily accessible tool, although, as I say, there is a long tradition of it. It's certainly nothing new. It's been endemic, I think, in most mystic or religious traditions at some point or other. And I guess for a few individuals who are dedicated to, you know, exploring their mind, it may be an option. But generally, I'm really wanting to put it on the agenda and suggest, well, was there something going on here? What were the mechanisms? And how could this be useful as a diagnostic tool rather than suggesting it's a cure-all? Because it currently it's not. I mean, it's just far too difficult for most people, and there are potential problems in terms of, you know, holding down a normal lifestyle or a normal situation. It would be very disruptive.
Or getting in a car and trying to drive or something like that.
Exactly, yes. As I say, it's more just trying to identify the components of the theory and make sense of them at the moment, rather than suggesting that sleep deprivation is necessarily going to be a useful tool.
Could diet play a role as well? Given that you think perhaps diet triggered the dysfunction in the first place, or a change in our diet, the loss almost, because I know you said in your book, Left in the Dark, it's almost like the parable of being expelled, Adam and Eve being expelled from the Garden of Eden. You know, they stopped eating the raw foods of the forest. Yeah. Diet, if we all started eating raw food, do you think it would affect our minds?
Yes, very much. And again, there's a lot of evidence for that, utterly independent of my proposals, comes out of, you know, even studies in prisons where quite literally you have a captive audience, and there's been approaches to look at diet and the effects on reoffending and just general levels of aggression and this kind of stuff. And the evidence is very strong that diet certainly affects the way the mind works, same with kids and anything from e-numbers to too much sugar to whatever. So, I think that's absolutely fundamental. I guess what's quite important here is the overall context, in that I'm saying there are three or four key factors here that have to be locked together. You change any one, you know, you stay awake, and yes, it can get a bit strange, but it's not going to have a great impact on its own. Or you change your diet to a more what I'd call a primate-like diet, and yes, it can have a few effects, but it's not particularly profound. It's putting these things together, I guess, is where I think it really starts to make a difference.
Do you meditate, Tony?
I don't have a particular regime. What I noticed, this is going back sort of 12 years now, when with my first experiments in sleep deprivation, I noticed the knock-on effect. The more runs I did, the more periods I stayed awake, that even when I wasn't actively staying awake, it was very easy to then relax and just slip into what I guess most people would call a meditative state. And that's remained the case, you know, ever since then. As I say, I, you know, if I sit down and relax for a few minutes, I can quite easily slip into a state that feels really good and relaxed. And it seems to have a strong correlation with what people talk about when they've, you know, been meditating for a while.
You're listening to Nights on Radio New Zealand Nash. I'm talking to Tony Wright. He's the author of a book called Left in the Dark. His theory is that we've got a dysfunctional left hemisphere of our brain. It dominates the right, shuts the right off, and affects the way we think. Tony, what's been the reaction to your ideas?
Well, over the years, somewhat bewildered, I think. But as I've drawn the information together and looked for supporting evidence in respected disciplines, and as well as the more traditional literature and sort of mythological literature, putting all these things together, I mean, this is one of the things I've maintained for a while, that to make such a radical proposal, there's absolutely no way it could have any validity if there wasn't already some evidence around. It's just too, you know, it's just too out there. And pulling all these things together and sort of effectively joining the dots, the reaction's been, thus far anyway, has been incredibly good right across the board. I've had reaction from a lot of, I don't know what the right term would be, but just the sort of general layperson, public or whatever. Most people can relate in their lives to things that have happened either in their childhood or currently that seem to, you know, it seems to make sense of what they experience, going right the way through to my initial approaches to sort of more academic institutions and individuals, which, you know, they tend to be a bit more conservative. But initial reaction, again, has been very positive thus far. I mean, it's still early days, and clearly I'm aware that it's a pretty radical proposal. But, yeah, so far very good.
Could it be, I'm just wondering about the left hemisphere, whether it's maybe not dysfunctional, but in our modern age when we're just overloaded sometimes, bombarded with information, and perhaps have been as people, as humans, compared to other animals ever since we started forming civilizations, that the left hemisphere is not dysfunctional, but it's a filter. And if it's not there to filter out information, if we get too much information, we can't cope. That's what happens with people who are autistic.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, that is a sort of a current theory, I suppose, to explain the left hemisphere role. And particularly, I think I mentioned before the Centre for the Mind in Australia. I think that's a general thinking there, that the left hemisphere is specialised and its role is to edit or filter, as you put it. And yeah, it's a theory. I'd suggest that the very fact it needs to filter or cannot cope is part of its dysfunction. And there are clearly individuals around who don't have that filter going on. They can cope with phenomenal amounts of throughput and information as easily as most of us can deal with everyday situations. So I'd suggest that filtering role that's been ascribed to the left hemisphere is actually part of its dysfunction, but again, we just don't see that.
The other thing is maybe it's not so much the brain, but the fact that we in the West in particular, but all civilizations perhaps, which where there's time, where we're thinking so much about the past or the future, which we tend to have to do in a Western civilization, we're always planning ahead. And the importance of the ego is what creates a lot of the dysfunction in the mind.
Yeah, again, it's an interesting perspective. And I can only say my interpretation would be, A, the very emergence of what we currently designate as civilization is in part of this slow degeneration. Some of the things that we've... you know, society is basically a reflection of our mind.
Yeah. I mean, going back to the start of the interview when we first started talking, you would say that we are afraid. The left hemisphere is ego. It's where the ego is. It's afraid.
It's inherently
And our whole society reflects that.
Very much, yeah. As I say, I put it all back to front, as it were, that the emergence of what we currently recognise and a lot of the hierarchies and structures we have are a symptom of this process of degeneration rather than the cause, and that would even go as far as including the way we conceptualize time and think about the past and the future and so on, as you referred to. And again, there's plenty anecdotal evidence that our very sense of time radically changes if you can shift your state of mind. So I would say even that, although it may have a real impact on the way we live our lives, it's also part of this process of degeneration where we just don't perceive reality anymore. We live in a world of invention and conception, and we mistake that for reality.
But now, you talked about the feedback. You talked about, okay, your theory would suggest dysfunctional left hemisphere is at the root of fear, perhaps at the root of ego-driven fear anyway. And, well, then we've created a world that supposedly provides a security for those fears. Mm. All the things in Western civilization which are about security in terms of all sorts of things, security in terms of shelter, violence, whatever. But now we've created that world which feeds back to the mind. Yeah. Can we really change the mind in that environment without changing the environment itself?
Sure. I mean, it's a sort of interwoven conundrum, really. I mean, I'm particularly interested in starting with the neurology and how it relates to the psychology, and then looking at the societies we've created. And I mean, you mentioned Western civilization, which I think is the more extreme manifestation, although I think it's endemic in pretty much any culture. The more complicated it's become, the more difficult that's going to be to change. But I would suggest that, you know, and I'm certainly not alone in this, that unless we can figure out a way to change, however challenging that may be, we're in pretty serious trouble. And I see a lot of the problems we have as symptomatic rather than problems in themselves, whether it be environmental or political or military. You know, a lot of people are trying to deal with symptoms when perhaps we should be looking at the thing that created that in the first place.
Do we need to go back to the forest?
No, I certainly don't want to slip into being portrayed as sort of, well, we just got to dump everything and return to the forest. I think that would be unrealistic, and quite clearly, if my proposal is correct, the forest didn't prevent, you know, living in the forest didn't prevent this condition emerging in the first place, because the forest itself is not, you know, immune from being susceptible to damage or ecological disaster. So no, I think it's looking at the biochemistry that the forest once provided, and the raw materials, literally and metaphorically, and looking how we can incorporate those as part of a wider solution. So it would be back to the forest in terms of the raw materials for building our brain rather than physically moving to the forest.
I'm going to finish by asking you a more optimistic question, which is, if our left hemispheres were not so dysfunctional, in your opinion, what is the potential? What could we do, us ordinary average humans, what could we do with our minds?
I think I personally, again, it's part of what's motivated me for the last 15 years. I think the potential is staggering. I think we touched on abilities, and those things tend to appeal to the mind more anyway, so it's always a good way in to talk about the sort of savant-like skills, phenomenal memory, phenomenal ability to calculate, artistic abilities, perfect pitch, music, even physical abilities, a kind of classic once-in-a-lifetime athletic performances where we have great physical prowess and perhaps a much more enhanced immune system. I think all those things, you know, this tentative evidence that those things may well exist. Going beyond that, my real interest is our state of mind and our psychology, and I think if we could live without this inherent fear that we tend to hide from ourselves, we treat ourselves and each other in a radically different way, and that, I think, is the key to what drives me. It's a wholly different way of perceiving ourselves and the world we live in.
Tony, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thanks so much for your time.
Okay, thanks very much.
Speaking to me from his home in Cornwall, that was Tony Wright. And the name of his book, again, if you missed it, Left in the Dark.